From the home of the codebreakers and the birthplace of modern computing, this is the Bletchley Park podcast. Welcome to the October 2016 episode of the Bletchley Park podcast, the party that saved Bletchley Park. This month we take you back 25 years to the first Veterans Reunion and all the way back to this year's. On the 19th of October 1991, Bletchley Park was about to be bulldozed for housing. A group of local historians organised the first, and they thought last, reunion of veterans of the Government Code and Cipher School in the very buildings where they did their war work. They believed it would be a chance for the veterans to have one last look around the site before it was consigned to history and bid it a fond farewell. That day, though, the veterans lent their support to a burgeoning desire among those local historians to stop Bletchley Park being torn down, and the campaign to save it for the nation was born. Volunteers recorded 14 hours of audio that day, capturing conversations and informal interviews with the veterans on cassette tapes. We've recently discovered that these audio cassettes had been digitised and were not, as feared, lost to history. And the campaign to save Bletchley Park from being bulldozed was not the only thing that party started. It was also the first of what's become the highlight of the year at Bletchley Park, the annual Veterans Reunion. This year's was another great day, with veterans bringing their families to remember and celebrate their contribution. And this year, for the first time, many of them were searching for their names, cemented firmly into Bletchley Park's future as well as its past, in the Codebreakers' Wall.
Good morning. Can I ask those of you who are able, please, to stand for the National Anthem?
I'm Molly Knutsell now. I was Molly Brewster and I worked in Hut 7, apparently, on the Japanese section. Yes, that's all I know, really, but I only knew that after I came here.
And your name's up on the wall today?
Yes, and my sister.
And your sister was here
my
as well,
my sister was here for 3 years of the war, and I was only here the last almost a year, not quite a year.
What do you think about the wall? Do you think it's a good idea? And
well, I think it's rather nice to be remembered, because it will be there for a long time, the wall, well, I expect, won't
you'll
it?
You'll be here forever, won't you? You thought you only came to do a little bit of service,
right,
here, and
yes,
you're going to be
that's
here for
right.
good.
Yes, absolutely.
Have you been to the reunion before?
Yes, I've been the last 3 or 4 years, actually, because
right.
I quite enjoy coming.
We must have missed you then.
We're a VIP for the day, you see, aren't we?
You're a VIP every day of the
no,
year.
No, I'm not.
All of the veterans are to us.
Oh, well.
But yes. It's good that you will be remembered forever, won't you?
It is rather
and
good, yes. Because nobody
name.
Heard of us for 30 years, no. You see, did they?
No.
That's the point, really.
I mean, I think that's a thing that a lot of people don't think of.
No.
Well, you not only did your service in World War Two. In a way, you carried on your service until the 70s, didn't you? Because you kept that secret.
Yes, nobody knew. Didn't think about it. And
no.
Even my sister and I, after the 30 years, we never spoke to
no.
it together. Hardly at all. I didn't even know which hut she was in.
No.
I didn't
you
even know.
You wouldn't, would you?
No.
There's so many veterans that I've spoken to, whether you feel the same, because you got to the end of the war and you you'd given up a certain amount of time of your lives.
Well,
you just
it changed
to carry
my
on with,
life totally.
You just wanted to kick,
absolutely,
like, start your
totally.
Life, didn't you?
Yes, absolutely.
A lot of people just wanted to go off and get married and have children, and others went to get an education, but it was, right, we're not going to talk about it, because we just want to get on with things.
That's right. Absolutely.
Well, can I say thank you so much for your service, and have a lovely day today.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Well, my name is Joan Smeaton.
And what was your role during the war?
I was an interceptor.
Here, at Bletchley Park?
No, not at Bletchley, but Scarborough.
Yeah.
You could see Scarborough and Flowerdale.
And what did you have to do?
Take down masses and masses of code messages.
How were you recruited for that?
Oh, because I was brought up in the west of Scotland, and when I started off in the Land Army, which didn't appeal to me whatsoever, not up there. And then I think about a week or two later, when I still didn't know quite what to do, the Navy had a recruitment thing in the local hotel. So I went along and joined the Wrens.
I bet you didn't know that you'd be
I didn't, because
codes.
What I wanted to do originally, because I was a country girl and brought up on an island, I could row, I could sail a boat, I was very, very useful on the boats, and the Wrens had just brought in a new category, which was boats crew, and I thought, well, that's for me, obviously. But when I was interviewed by the Wren officer, she said, oh yes, lovely that, but she said, I'm afraid it's very, very popular. And she said, what else would you like to do? And to this day, I don't know why I said wireless. I mean, I wasn't particularly interested in... So that was it. I was up within a fortnight. I was down in London, and then I went on the course and learned all about it, except what it was we were going to do. I mean, I didn't know till years later. And so I spent nearly 3 years at Scarborough intercepting.
And was it hard keeping it secret?
No, because I think they were very clever. They didn't give us enough information to think it was any worth exchanging or telling anybody. I mean, I never told my family. All they knew was I was a wireless operator. Mm. That was it. And quite frankly, we didn't know ourselves how important it was. We never knew what happened to all this German Enigma stuff we were taking down from subs. Once they were put on top of our machines and whisked away, we didn't know where they went, what they went. I think maybe they might have given us a little hint and made it more interesting. We might have been a bit better operators if we'd known a little bit more. But as it was, you know, night watch, you got fed up and the signals weren't very good. So anyway, it all worked out in the end. But as I say, I wish I'd known earlier so that I could have told my family.
So how did you feel when you did eventually find out how important your work had been?
Things began to click into place then, you know. The answers came to me. Well, that's why we did so-and-so, and that's why... Oh, yes, of course, I see now, but we didn't have the information.
Do you use the skills that you learnt
anymore? I can still do the Morse code, but I don't use them now. I did for a short time, because I lived in Africa for 13 years after the war, and I joined the local police force out there, simply because I could do Morse, and they wanted somebody to, not that I haven't ever had to do it, but I was there. I spent my 13 years in Africa. My husband was a vet, and so we were in the bush a lot.
I guess you didn't really think about it. It was just a job you did during the war.
I mean, I got married again because my first husband died in Africa, quite young. I remarried, and my second husband didn't. He was an ex-bomber pilot. So my first husband was in the Royal Army Veterinary Corps. So it was Army, Navy, Air Force. And we never actually, you didn't talk much about it in those days, just in wireless.
No. I think that's what people these days find so hard to understand, because we're all sharing our feelings all the time. And
I know. But in a way, I think it's a pity, because, I mean, I've been asked in the meantime, and my family want me to write my story, and I've got my childhood and the war done, but I've still got to do my African years, and the trouble is recalling, and the older you get, unless you meet somebody who's been in a similar position, and they say something, you say, I remember that, you know, I remember that place at Scarborough, we used to go dancing on a Saturday night. we enjoyed our life there, it wasn't too bad.
Well, I married a suitor.
And what did you do?
I was a bomb operator, Eastcote, and then in Stanmore.
And, well, you must have had this before. You don't hold enough. You must have been very young and towards the end of the war, was it?
I joined when I was just 17.
And what was it like? What are your memories of that work and that time?
They have recorded it on the, whatever it is called,
this the website oral history thing. Project.
Yes, that's right.
That's more in depth. This is just to help us kind of encourage people to be interested in Bletchley Park.
Oh, I see.
And we're looking at. Have you bought a brick?
Yes, there's a brick, and my friend, dear friend, who was also here, she was in Hut 6. And we're together.
And is she no longer?
She died some years ago. Yes.
Did you buy the brick in her name?
Yes.
That's a lovely thing to do. How does it feel to see it there now?
It's
with you?
Very moving.
Mr. Photographer, it's all yours.
Thank you. Hello, everybody. Can you all see me? If you can't see me, you're probably behind somebody, so you might need to scooch a bit. I'm just going to make sure that everybody's out of the corners. And I'll give you a 3, 2, 1, and a big smile, and we'll take a picture, okay? Oh, he's got a... Are you looking for a chair, madam? You're looking for a chair, because you're like a tall poppy. One more coming, and then we're all good. If you don't come in the window...
We're all good.
Everybody smile, then. 3, 2, 1. Wonderful. I'm just going to check these, make sure you're all smiling. Wonderful.
Just before we do that, folks, can I just say, quick 3 cheers for our veterans. Hip, hip.
Hooray!
Hip, hip.
Hooray!
Elizabeth Ross, I was. I'm now Elizabeth Davies.
And what did you do, Elizabeth?
I was on Japanese naval coast.
When did you join?
1944.
So you were here at Bletchley Park rather than one of the
For a year, yes, the last year of the war.
And how was it? What's your memory of it like?
Well, it's a long, long time ago. We did this shift work, of course, and you only had 2 days off, I think, every month when your shift changed. And we worked in rather gloomy conditions in the hut. And my hut has disappeared.
Yeah, some of them were knocked down, weren't they?
Well, it certainly was, yes. They can't even find the foundations anywhere.
No, we did an £8 million restoration a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
And we found some foundations under what had been a car park for a while. It's landscaped over now, but not Hut 7, unfortunately.
No, right.
It's the classic thing, isn't it? When you've just finished with something,
yes.
You don't value it historically,
absolutely.
Do you?
So, and I mean, they were just about to tear the whole place down, weren't they?
Yes.
When it was saved.
More than once. Yeah.
Yes. Yes.
Is this the first time you've been back?
No, I've been back regularly.
And what's it like to come back and see your name and the brick?
It's nice to see Hut 8 restored like that. I never went inside Hut 8. You never went inside anybody else's office, let alone into somebody else's hut. The security was very, very tight. And you knew... The minimum, you know, you knew what you had to know.
Yes, just
and
what
no
you needed
more. Yes,
to
exactly.
Do your job, yeah.
And you passed on. I mean, I was on decoding, and we had to break... Mainly I was on JN40. We had to break it every week and decode the messages that came in and pass them on to the translator. And the translator passed them on. You know, probably the most interesting job here was the strategy, but I don't know, because they were actually perhaps passing messages on to where they were going to be used, which is more related to what's going on in the world, isn't it?
Because you're getting a tiny pinhole view, if you like, of a little bit.
Yes, that's right. You just have a tiny view.
Yeah.
And I've learnt more about it since I've left, much more.
Did you know how important it was at the time, do you think?
Knew very little, really, at the time. Just what you needed to know. And we went on a month's course of Japanese and learnt the words we needed to know. And they wouldn't be very helpful to you in Tokyo. Things like submarine, merchant ship, north, south, east, west.
Tools of the trade.
Yes, yes, that's right. Yes, absolutely.
Are you in touch with anyone you worked with? Did you?
I kept in touch with two people that I worked with here until they died. And one 20 years ago, and one probably about 15 years ago. So no, I don't know anyone, but I always find people interesting to talk to. And I learn other things about Bletchley that I didn't know at the time.
There's always more,
which is
isn't
great.
There?
Yes, yes. That
keeps on going.
Yes, that's it.
Thank you very much.
Bye bye.
My name is Gerald Hall. I was on a wise station or a ship. I wanted to go to sea.
Yeah.
I didn't want to be on shore. I nagged them and worried them so much they sent me. They got rid of me.
Coming to Bletchley Park, how does that feel for you?
Well, so much of it was an unknown. Always just to us it was a word, and that's as far as it went. We knew nothing further about it. But I was telling somebody the most important message we intercepted at, sometimes at sea, sometimes on shore, from a German submarine was what is called a convoy sighting report. They made the hair on the back of your neck stick out.
What does it mean?
It was so frightening. They found a convoy and were reporting it back to Berlin where its position was. That's what the sighting report was. And if you didn't get that message, probably lots of lives would be lost. So it was very, very responsible. And there were different codes we learned. When I joined up in Skagnes, HMS Arthur, the man who was doing it asked me if I spoke German. Unfortunately, I'd done German at school. So I said, yes. He said, well, I'm down. And then on my whole route of my career in the Navy was knocked out. I go from here to there, to there, to there, to there. All in the pursuit of intercepting communications from German sources. And later, when I came back and the second front had begun, a great friend of mine in the Navy was on taking part, and I was very jealous of him. I wanted to be there too, but I couldn't be. So I went and did Japanese, volunteered to go and do the Japanese section of the war. So I had to learn Japanese Morse.
Wow.
And in addition to that, Japanese radar. So I had two methods of interception. One was through the earrings, and the other was through a cathode ray tube, the TV. So I had to know the signs visually for TV,
yeah.
Orally for the earphones.
Yeah.
A lot to remember.
Yes.
Then on top of that, when you were intercepting Japanese Morse, which was very fast, 88 words a minute, at the end of that message, you had a cosign to put in, as well as the one you were receiving for four letters. So you had a lot to remember.
Yeah.
And you trained for.
Marigold Angela McNeely was Bostock Wilson. And you were?
Diana Lloyd.
And what were you before you were married?
Tyler.
And so what did you do?
I worked on the bomb in Hut 11. And I was stationed at Woburn Abbey and also Crawley Grange. And I have an invitation from the Duchess to go and look around Woburn today.
Oh, how lovely.
So I'm really looking forward to it.
So that's your next stop?
Yes.
And so this isn't the first time you've been back to visit?
No, 3 years ago we came to Bletchley. You were here at Bletchley 3 years ago too, right?
3 years ago. Yeah. Because we got the photo, haven't
yes.
we?
Did we're you know each other during the war or afterwards?
We didn't work together.
No.
But
we met after the war. We were stationed at HMS Royal Arthur, which was at Corsham, while Prince Philip was there. And she and I were talking about, we had mixed hockey.
With Philip.
With Philip.
Yes.
And he was very mean. He bashed, I don't care, I'm American now. Yeah. He bashed the girls, the Wren's legs to get the ball away from them.
So there's a touch of equality about that, isn't there? But I'm not sure it's the most gentlemanly thing. Maybe he was treating you like one of the boys.
Yeah, yeah, we had fun. We had to sit in the back of the lorry, didn't
yes, we
to
did.
Get there.
Yes. We were transported in the back of lorries.
In the back of a lorry.
Yes.
It must be nice for you two to be able to get back
oh,
together
we're
again.
A wonderful
oh, it's
couple.
Been lovely.
Yes. I'm 90. How old are you?
90.
We're both 90.
And you live in the States?
Yes.
Whereabouts?
In Louisiana, just north of New Orleans.
So you don't presumably get back to the UK?
No,
too many
3 years ago. Yeah. That was the last time, yes. Yes. But Diana came. We used to have a farm in Louisiana, and Diana came and spent Christmas with us in Louisiana.
Yes, it was lovely.
How long are you back over for this time?
2 weeks.
Well, it's wonderful that you can get together and
I know,
make new memories.
We have such memories.
Yeah. Did you tear the town up when you were younger?
We did. She wanted to know if we tore the town up. We got into all kinds of trouble.
Where? In London.
Yeah. In London and at Corsham.
Yes.
And Diana was just telling them I was the first and only captain's defaulter because I got drunk and disorderly. We were selling poppies for November the 11th, is that Veterans Day?
Yeah.
She and I were going around the camp selling poppies. This was after the war. And everywhere we went, in the petty officer's mess, they gave us a tot of rum, which was very strong, navy rum, wasn't it?
Yes.
Then we couldn't get back on our bicycles because we were falling off. The poppies were going everywhere. And
We were disgraced.
Yeah. And when I went to the captain's cabin, or where it was, I decided that he needed this great big, I think not plastic, wax poppy in his buttonhole. And of course, when I tried to put it on him, he smelled all the whiskey that I'd been drinking, and that's why I was captain's defaulter.
Oh, dear. But you got away with it.
Yes, she did.
I'm hearing nothing from you. I think you were there too, weren't you?
I was there too.
Were you falling off your bike as well?
Yeah, she was falling off, and all her poppies went everywhere too.
Everywhere.
But she didn't try and put the poppy in the captain's buttonhole.
Are you not going to quite go to those lengths now? Now, are you?
No.
Okay.
No.
You're not going to get roaring drunk together
no,
now.
No.
I can't drink
now. No, I think none of us can quite drink what we did when we were 19, can we?
Exactly.
No.
I still like my cider because I'm from Somerset.
It's wonderful that you can get back together, and thank you for sharing part of your day with me.
Well, thank
have you.
Have
a wonderful time at Woburn
sure
as well.
Thank you.
It's 1991, and a handful of local historians have just left a council meeting feeling dejected. Plans are steaming ahead to bulldoze the site where code-breaking work took place during World War II, producing top-secret intelligence which had a profound impact on the outcome of the conflict. It's set to be lost forever, to make way for houses, a supermarket and a petrol station. Then the scheming began. Newly retired diplomat and local historian Peter Westcombe, to whose determination a mere 8-foot fence was no barrier, knew if he could get the media to tell the world the wonderful stories of the former codebreakers, they might be in with a chance of stopping the bulldozers in their tracks. Behind that 8-foot fence was Doreen Sawyer, who worked for British Telecom. It was her job to keep the site secure and manage the move to new offices. She hadn't bargained for the passion of Peter and his pals, or for how successful that party would be.
Bletchley Station.
Well, I knew Bletchley Park existed from before. When I was with the diplomatic service, I was at Hounslow Park, some 17 miles away. And Hounslope Park is a direct result of the wartime activities of Bletchley Park, because the intercept activity, especially the Abwehr German Secret Service traffic, was intercepted by all my colleagues who then worked in Hounslope Park. So after 1974, when the whole thing became open, they actually told me the stories of what was happening in there. And I got to know so many of them, and I became fascinated. Well, the other thing was this. When I joined the diplomatic service in 1960 up here, I didn't have a house. That we were living down in Essex, so I came up here to stay and try and buy a house. We were then using Hut 3, the intelligence hut, as our hostel. So I knew Hut 3, I knew the other huts, and of course, having heard the story from my colleagues in Hounslope Park, I could put the whole lot together. And I realised, in fact, this site had a story really worth telling. And that's how the whole thing started off. The alarm bell started ringing in early 1991, when there was a meeting of the Bletchley Council, or Milton Keynes Council, I forget now. And the decision, in fact, was taken there that Bletchley Park did not need to be saved. They could give planning permission for a housing estate, I think of 300 houses, a garage and a small superstore. Now, I went to that meeting with my good colleague, Peter Jarvis. Now, Peter and I had known Peter for years whilst I was in the dip service. I used to come home, my wife and I, and that, with a few bugs, and we used to go and see Peter and that, so we knew Peter very well. So I was got an idea. I said, well, you know, Peter and I went down to the meeting, and afterwards he said, well, that's it. There's nothing we can do. See, this was BT property. BT had got planning permission to demolish the site. It was a site, of course, it's a very valuable site. It's just by the side of the railway station. You can fall out of bed, into a train to London, back home again. No parking fees, nothing at all. So we knew it was going to be a bit of a hard one, that we appealed to their better nature. Then I went home, and about 2 or 3 weeks later, I suddenly had an idea. So I suggested to my wife, if we could only get a farewell party here for all the wartime staff we would find, and we get all the media down here to get them to interview them and tell the story, maybe we could do something. I said, but the trouble is, I said, of course, I don't know anyone around here because I spent most of our lives overseas. So she said, well, why don't you ask Peter? He was a GP. He knew everyone for miles. So Rona and I invited ourselves down for tea with Peter and Sue Jarvis, and I discussed the thing with them, and they said, yes, what a good idea. Just get a party going and to see if we can get the media in. And that's how the whole thing started there. How are we going to get this party going? So we sat and thought, and the four of us, we said, well, what we need to do, in fact, is A, to get permission to use the park, and B, then to be able to find all the people who were here throughout the war, as many as we can, to invite them in. And C, we've got to feed them. So I said, well, I'll look after A, getting permission to go in the park. Peter said he will look after B, getting the names and addresses of the people, so to invite them. And C, Sue and my wife said, we'll organise the catering. So off we went. So I had some contacts anyway down the West Country, and I got two addresses off them in the first place. One was Harry Hinsley, Sir Harry Hinsley. Another one was Edward Thomas, Captain Thomas of Royal Navy, who was in Hut 4. And they gave the addresses to me. I gave them to Peter. And we said, well, if we write Peter Jarvis, or Peter and Sue Jarvis, and Peter Ernie Westcombe, invite you to Bletchley Park. Mind, we hadn't got permission then to invite you to Bletchley Park to this big party. They would say, well, who the devil are these people? But if we say the Bletchley Archaeological and Historical Society, of which we are both members, if we say they invite you, maybe we'll get a result. We asked the Historical Society, and they said yes. So we then had the major meeting. There was Peter and Sue, my wife and myself. Peter got a councillor in, Roger Bristow, and he came in as well. And a chap called Ted Legg, who was a local historian, came in there. And Ian Halmos, who was the chairman of the Bletchley Archaeological Society. And we all sat in Peter's house, having invited ourselves to tea. And we had a long chat and decided how to divvy the whole thing up, and this is how it would work. So off everybody went. Well, I had to get into the park. So the gates, of course, were wide open in those days. So I walked in the park and promptly got thrown out by a woman who said, you're not allowed in here, private property. And I said, no, get out, shoo, shoo, shoo. So she shooed me out the gate. So I then went down the path by the side of the gate, found a gap in the railings where one of the railings had broken off, came back through a gap in the railings and went into the office where I saw the lady who was, in fact, looking after the place before it was handed over to be demolished. And she said, well, you know, I have to get permission of that. This was dear old Doreen Sawyer. Doreen, by the way, after she retired, for 8 years was one of our most loyal volunteers, bless her heart.
I started, I'll tell you when, in October 55.
Did you have any awareness at that time of what had gone on there?
No. Now, I went there in 55, and obviously you hear rumours what was happening during the war. Even when I went in, you always had to wear a security disc. You couldn't just walk in the park.
When we fast forward to sort of the late 80s, early 90s, and the likes of Peter Westcombe climbing through a broken fence to come and talk to you.
That's right.
About a party.
He couldn't get through the gate, you see.
But he did. What do you remember about that?
Believing that I was going on holiday, I think it was on a Friday, and my receptionist rang and said, Mrs. Sawyer, there is a gentleman walking around the college. He's got no disc on him at all. She said, he's making his way down to your area. So I ran out and saw this gentleman, and I said, excuse me. I said, but where is your security disc? Oh, he says, I haven't got one. I says, then who are you? He says, I'm looking for Hut 3. I says, well, I'm sorry. I don't know where Hut 3 is. And as you haven't got a disc, I've got every right to have you removed from the premises. And what I'm going to do, I'll give you 3 to move out, or I call the police and have you arrested. And he said, please, please, don't let that happen. I says, well, you must go. And then he said, can I just have 5 minutes with you? I says, what do you want? And he said, well, we've started a historical society and we would like to preserve Bletchley Park. Well, then my ears pricked up. And I said to him, all right, tell me about it. And he roughly filled me in that these people, there was only about 4 of them, going to start on this preservation of Bletchley Park. He said, and the most important hut is Hut 3. And then Peter said, you do know where it is, don't you? And I said, yes, but I'm not telling you. I said, look, I'm going on holiday and I won't be back for a fortnight. He says, can I come and talk to you? So I says, right, but I wouldn't tell him then until I made inquiries who he was. Come back from holiday, and Peter had rung up, made an appointment to see me, and I said to him, I'll show you on one condition and one condition only. He says, what? I says, you never, ever tell anyone where it is, because I don't want to take that responsibility, because by that time I had found out what Hut 3 was all about. And I said, because people will come and they'll be taking bits away. So I took him in, and of course he was absolutely thrilled. And then he said, right, would you like to come onto the committee?
So I didn't know this till we were coming up to the party. She contacted BT and said, can these people have permission just to throw this farewell party? BT asked, well, about how many people? She said, I shouldn't think. No more than about 20. Okay, on that basis, okay. Well, as the invitation list soared past 200, we thought, please don't let BT turn up. Please don't let BT turn up.
Now, Peter has, all these years down the line, confessed that he told you there'd be about 20 people.
That's right, that's right. It was a nightmare. He said, would you be able to do anything, Ryan? I said, well, if there's only 20 of you, tea and biscuits, fine. Well, it was over 200, wasn't there? Well, by this time, names started to pour in. Remember, as I said to you, I had not said a word to my boss man. He didn't know anything about this. And in the end, I think when we got over the 100, I thought, no way can I cope with this without saying something. So I went into my boss and I said, look, I've got something terrible to tell you. He says, what have you done? I said, I think I'm going to get thrown out. I said, I've overstepped the mark. And he said, right, let's have it. And I told him, he says, oh, Dorian, what the heck are we going to do? I said, I don't know. I said, I'm just stuck with tea and biscuits at the minute. He says, look, leave it with me. So he rang headquarters in London and told them, and the director said, yes, go ahead with it. It's quite important. See what you can do and sort it out. Permission has been granted. And that's how it started. And believe you me, I never slept for a week. Because every day, I mean, they gave me the task, you see, of getting the names. Because obviously I was always on duty. So my number had been given. And people were ringing up and saying, well, I'm coming. And I was taking all these names, and I was absolutely astounded. Do you know, this was all done within literally weeks, not months, to organise.
It's quite incredible. The turnout was amazing. When you look at that list of distinguished names, it must have been quite a memorable day.
Oh, it was. But the strange thing was, you see, you'd get a car turning up at the gate with a driver, but they hadn't given me the driver's name. And my husband was on the gate. He was checking them out. We had walkie-talkies the old time. I've got a Mr. So-and-so here, but he's got another man with him. And I used to say, well, what's the man's name? And he said, well, he's not on the list. He can't come in. He says, but he's his driver. What do we do? So you can imagine. I mean, we weren't prepared.
chaos.
Is yeah. Chaos.
A day of sort of panic. When you look back on it, it must look a lot more fun than it was on the day.
Oh, it was pandemonium.
Yeah.
It was pandemonium.
The party took place. It was a roaring success. I got all the press and that, all of them in here, and interviewed them. Now, what really made me determine this park was going to be saved was one small incident. I was walking around the park with these two men I didn't know from Adam. One was Harry Hinsley, and the other one was a chap called Stuart Milderberry, who was the head of Hut 6. So you had the Harry Hinsley, of course, the art foreman, also this became number two here, and also wrote the great his magnum opus, British Intelligence in the Second World War. He, in fact, was talking with Stuart Milderberry and also with Edward Thomas, and they were walking down the lake, and I was walking with them. And they got round to where the steps are, and Stuart Milderberry said, "Do you remember, Harry, when you came in roaring drunk and drove your cycle into the lake?" Because Harry, of course, was very sort of a straight-laced bloke. Harry said, "Yes," he said. "And do you remember what you said?" Harry said, "No." He said, Stuart said, "Please don't tell Hillary. Please don't tell Hillary." Because, you see, Hillary was his girlfriend. He married her afterwards. But she also was a very quiet lady. And the thought of this chap she was going to marry, sort of wobbling up to the lake and probably falling in with his bike. And I thought, yes, that's the sort of thing we need. Not just the straight-laced stuff of the code breaking. These were normal, ordinary people doing an extraordinary job. That's the story I wanted to get. So that's what really kicked the whole thing going, made us determined, and we determined this site really was going to be saved. So that's how the whole thing took off after the party.
I mean, this is the lake area here.
Yeah.
Right? Well, the mansion's over there.
Pardon?
The mansion is over there.
We were down here.
You were down here?
Yes.
Okay,
yes.
Shall we go and have a look?
Yes. Are you coming? Yes. Do you not see Loxie was down here? You see, there's the mansion there.
Right.
And this is the lake here. It must be down here.
It's
one
right
foggy night, we nearly walked into it because we used to have to go over to the main, didn't we, over there to our meal.
Right. Yeah.
And then it was black as pitch, you know. We were,
right.
It was really quite frightening.
Hey,
the
right.
Geese. Were you here when the geese ran by the lake? Because they were clear.
Is that right? There were geese around here.
Coffee.
Yeah.
Mansion bit. That's up there somewhere.
Yeah, yeah, it's there. Yeah.
Mind you, you know, there wasn't roads like, well, there was a road, but it wasn't, hadn't got double yellow lines
and all that. Yes.
I can remember these geese, you don't walk past them.
They must have been left behind.
Our block was one large room with bays off. You know, there wasn't. Mm-hmm. And
that's where I was. Where we've just been.
But of course, that Hut 7.
Oh yeah,
but it could have been about there. I don't know whether that is.
It's flat tail. Yeah.
You see, I think this is definitely. Isn't it?
This is it down here, or this is the you were down around here.
Right, you go come around the back.
This is it. It wasn't a two-story building.
Right.
It was only a one-story building. All the windows were high up. This,
yes.
Look, it's got block C here.
There you are. Yes.
Look, it's got block C. Look.
Yeah.
You see how it was all sort of done in bays?
Yes.
But when you're in there, you can't look out of the windows.
Were there blast walls in front of it?
No. It was just that they were high up.
Oh, they were high, and
we were.
I see.
Well, I should imagine it's virtually the same.
Yeah, it probably
is. I think, Sybil, virtually the same.
Yeah, I thought you said much something about it was in ruins. But
yeah.
When you were down in it, you
got light coming through, but you didn't actually look out.
I don't think we got light.
Right.
Were those steps there?
It's all blacked out.
Not that makes a lot of difference.
Yes, this was ours.
Thank you, Florence.
Yes.
I've been following you about.
I've been looking for you.
This gentleman wants to know. This is one of the you got on your list.
Oh, fine.
Florence Howard.
Right. Right.
Yes. Miss Sybil.
Yeah. Hello. Nice
to
see.
Is this the dining room?
No, it's the ballroom.
That's the neon
ballroom.
I'm say it wasn't gamble.
No.
And do you remember what went on in here?
Yeah.
Or were you ever?
Oh no.
No.
We never came in here.
Is that the dining room? In there, because you didn't have your meals here, did you?
Because no, the dining room is what is they call the lounge now. Why I'm interested in it, because my father worked on the panelling.
Did he?
When not during the war,
before.
Years before the war.
But he worked on the making of this panelling here.
Yes.
Yeah. That's amazing, isn't it?
Yeah. No, I said, is that Florence? I've seen it so long since I've seen it. That I wasn't known you anyway.
I mean, I've seen you quite recently.
Yeah, because you've seen him.
Yeah, Queenie decided not to come then and then.
Well, when I rang up the lady to see if I could come, she said, please don't tell any more of your friends. They couldn't cope with it.
Oh, no, so. That is a point.
I mean, I think there has been a problem. There were so many people who could have come that they would be completely swamped for catering and medical facilities. Yes. I think that was part of the problem.
To limit it
she said it was
lovely. Isn't it lovely?
It used to be a beautiful
ballroom.
Yeah.
It really
did.
I looked for you.
I wonder if the lights look quite light, do they?
No, it's a bit
heavy. No, they could be. They could be a modern day.
I'm not sure during the war, but as I say, I worked in the 10 years after the war.
Yes.
And they used to have the dances and that in here.
That's what I remember dancing.
Interesting. Incredible. I've never seen anything like it.
My languages were French and Spanish.
Yes.
And also I hadn't been trained. I wasn't a mathematician or language graduate or anything.
No.
And that's why we were thrown into this index, which was run by a funny little man from the British Museum.
What was his name?
Mr. Sainton. Like a little mole. Little hair, most extraordinary. With all these glamorous girls all around with lovely languages. And I think he was terrified of us all.
But was he a master of that index?
He was in charge of it, yes.
Right.
And you see, to us it was a bit boring, obviously.
Yes.
We didn't understand what was, unless there was some special thing happening. It was, to us it was a bit boring.
Yes.
And we used to sort of sing songs and have a French evening and have one day, as a friend of mine said, we all had a notice on the board saying, tomorrow everybody arrives, walks in wearing hats, and you had to do something to break the monotony.
Yes.
Because you had three watches, 9 to 4 one week, 4 till midnight the next, midnight till 9 the next, and you didn't go away for a break except after a fortnight,
right.
Sometimes 3 weeks, and then you had 2 or 3 days off.
Yes.
But you worked all through the 2 weeks.
Yes, 7 days a week.
And the food was ghastly and the canteen was terrible.
Yes.
And so, it was quite a strain. People were always having tummy upsets. And they were, because it was, if you were doing a very high level, very important, and you understood what was going on, it's obviously more interesting. Because I used to call this my nightmare finishing school, really.
Oh,
I learned a lot. From a fairly sort of protected, sort of continental style family, to be plunged into this place with what we thought were a lot of old, boring old dons, they're all over 40, and to us at our age, that was very old.
Yes.
No nice young men around.
Yes. Had you escaped from France?
Oh, no. We came to England before
the war.
Yes. Thank goodness. We were very lucky to be here. It was quite an experience, though, and I'm supposed to be, it was when you heard some terrible things happening, like the PQ convoys to Russia sinking, and that sort of thing was really upsetting.
Yes.
And a friend of mine's husband was in the hood, and then when she heard the hood went down with all
that went fast.
Awful. And in that climate, I mean, in icy waters of that, it was terrible.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, a fascinating collection of girls who were part something else, who knew languages, who was, that's why I call it really my nightmare finishing school, because but it's certainly a very important part of one's life, really. But this is a bit that I'll never forget, certainly, and I met some very good friends here.
Well, there are people meeting here today that
have been
tremendous
friends. Yes, it really is awful. Sometimes you think, I don't recognize them.
Right.
Dreadful.
And do you still live in France?
No, I live in London. I've lived a lot abroad.
Right.
Most of my family and I are in London, really. I've got cousins in France, but most of my family are in London.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what's attached to your good friends and your family, really.
Yes.
An important thing in life.
Yes, that's great.
Where do you come from?
Montreal.
Oh, Montreal. Oui. Oui, alors vous parlez le français?
Oui, je parle français.
Très bien, très bien.
I'm talking to Mr. William Millward.
XR3.
When were you here?
42 to 46. When I came here, one warning I was given was that it was a complete social solecism to join in the game of rounders being played on this lawn.
Right.
But that was reserved for the director and his friends. But in order to facilitate that, they put two concrete circles, one for the batter and one for the bowler, in the grass over there. And when the mob got here, they couldn't do that anymore. So the story then told was that those two concrete circles were for statues. The big one was for the director, and the small one was for the deputy director.
Right.
But you needn't believe that unless you want to. Other thing here is this pond, this lake, hadn't got these bushes.
Right.
And was the only place in England where I've ever really heard frogs croak. Right. They used to croak like fury, and we used to listen to them. We're over from Hut 3, which was there at 2 o'clock in the morning, middle of the midnight shift, to the canteen, which was somewhere there, to a grisly meal.
Can you just say a bit more about the food, the type of food that you used to get given? We can wander.
Well, the only thing I can remember about that meal was that there were no staff on it. There were only the people at the counter who gave you the food. And so, starting at about 12:30, the empties just accumulated on all the tables. And if you were a bit late and went in for your breakfast about 3 o'clock, you had a grisly mess of dirty plates on the table in front of you. And what you were issued for breakfast was one small rasher of bacon, which was usually very fat. And for the mixture of fat and dirty plates was most revolting. And then people used to behave rather curiously at the small hours. I don't know why. If we were working all night, around about 6 o'clock, various things overtake you. There was one man who always used to chase the girls around the park. I don't think he ever caught them. But that was a sort of midnight madness to seize everybody.
Yes. Would you like to go to Hut 3?
We are standing between Hut 6 and Hut 3. Mr. Millwood is going to explain the plank between the two.
Oh, I see you're recording me.
Yes, I'm recording you.
It was somewhere here. Hello, Reginald. Can you remember where the famous shuttle came across? Somewhere?
Well, that's something has happened. I think a lump's been built on the end.
There never too many of them.
But it was somewhere here, wasn't it?
Crosswise, it's been.
That's right. Yeah. Well, it was just a plank that we ran across.
That's right. And a broom. Floor broom, and you pushed them. They worked beautifully all
Absolutely,
night, 24
yes.
hours a day, back and forth.
And the purpose of it was?
To pass papers back and forward.
Messages had been put through the machines here.
From
Germany. It went that way. To him.
That's right.
To you in Hut 3.
Hut 6 was where the...
Sprechen Sie Deutsch?
Ja, mein Herr.
It was here. Where... Was that by the lake? You may only have come at that time.
I think I remember being up there actually.
Was that
by
just
the house?
The house?
Yes,
for the house.
Good,
yeah.
My name is okay. Right.
Then we were in the house for a bit.
Yes.
It'd be quite amusing to see in the house. The big room with the lovely big windows.
Jean was there, wasn't she?
This is the lake here. Parents.
So that gives you some point of reference.
That's it, that's it. So Anne, you said we moved on.
Yes, we did.
Ah.
First of all, we were in Hut 4.
I've always been in Hut 4. I don't know how long for. I worked with Pamela Gibson, Pamela Rose, Jean Campbell Harris,
Lady Trumpington.
What a pity.
Met up with quite a few people today then.
Yes, not as many actually as we thought, about five. It's awfully difficult, you see, lots of people who didn't hear about you couldn't have had millions here anyway. You already have quite a large group. But I suppose a lot of people didn't, for instance, there were quite a few Wrens. And they obviously didn't know about it. That's a problem. We were a hell of a lot of people here.
But is this the one that goes along around the corner?
That, I think, is Hut 3, which must be that side of us. This is Hut 6.
That's 3, that's 6.
Yes. Well, I believe there was a communication between...
Well, that's right, there was
two.
And that's what I was...
You can't see it here, because it's in a room which has got a faulty floor now, and you can't... It's unsafe.
I wonder if we can see it outside.
You can see it outside.
Oh, Bob Watson said he put it there.
You can see where it was, yeah.
Ah, thank you. Now, that ties it down, because...
Hooray.
Because I wrote a book about...
The Jap side.
This is Alan. Yes, thank you.
Well, that's exactly where it was.
That's right, guilty. Thank you. And that definitely... Because I put down in my book what I reckoned was 368. In fact, I think I put down what you said. But I thought it was Bob Watson who was persuading me that I got it wrong.
Well, that, I believe, is 8.
Yes, it must be, mustn't it? Now, that's the one that goes around the corner, and this is about 3/4 of the mill, so somewhere there it would have been.
Yes, that's it. That's
it, isn't it? Quite a small hatch.
I mean, I haven't found anybody who could tell me what happened in 8, except that it was naval.
Oh, 8 was the breaking of naval, and 4, which I think is the one that was down on the far side of the mansion, was the making of the intelligence from it.
Right.
You see, the higher number, I don't know if this is an accident, but the two ones multiplied by two, as it were, the six and eight, were respectively Army and Air and Luftwaffe for six.
Right.
Breaking that part of the Enigma, doing most of the breaking, and then passing the results through the hatch, and then three were the people who converted it, rewrote it deliberately, and converted it into signals which went out to the different commands saying what the news was, as it were. They converted it from Enigma into Ultra.
So the traffic was this way through the hatch?
That's right, that's it. Yes, it would have been. And eight broke the naval Enigma more slowly and later, because it was always tougher, and passed it on to four, which did the, which is where Hinsley was, which again processed it all. You see, the point was, unlike the Germans, who paid the price for it, how shall I put it, if the Germans had intercepted any of our stuff and broken it, which sent out the reports to commands and to the Admiralty, and if they recognised that this information was stated in the same terms as their own broken messages, they'd have smelt a rat.
That's right.
And this is where Winterbottom came in. He got all sorts of things wrong, but he, I don't know if he invented it, he presided over the Ultra system, which was that Ultra must never restate messages spoken in their original terms. They must always change it round, keeping the same information. And then terrific organisation that it mustn't be acted on in a way which could be attributed by the Germans exclusively to code-breaking.
Yeah.
And in the Mediterranean, before they sank a ship or attacked something or anything, on the basis of Ultra, Ultra being the cover term for the finished product, not the breaking, not the real decrypts, they mustn't act on it until they'd sent out an air patrol or something to, quote, accidentally find the U-boat convoy and so on, and give time for it to send a meaningless message back to base, which the Germans could intercept but couldn't make because it was meaningless, and time for it to be attacked. And although this meant they lost some targets, it meant the Germans, whenever they thought they smelt a rat, they can never prove it. Or somebody said, well, you know, there was this aircraft and it could have spotted us.
The moral dilemma of knowing things that you couldn't act upon, did that cause a lot of stress?
I don't think it did. I think, honestly, there wasn't much time for stress. Yes. You see, there's always a pile of stuff to be done.
Yeah, that's right.
And I was never high enough up. Very few people were high enough up to get anywhere near that. I don't know how, quite how to put it. I don't think it somehow arose.
Yeah.
You see, it was always, you're almost always full of the technical problems rather than the moral implications, really.
Yes.
I think it's only since the war that anybody's thought about the moral ones.
Yes.
Much really.
It was Joan Pyman when I was at Bletchley in 1943 to 1945, and I'd like to say how nice it is to be back and seeing it so very more immaculate and well ordered than it was when we were there all those years ago. But at least Bletchley Park, the house is still there, and the lake that we used to walk around.
You said that it's much more immaculate than it appears to be.
Well, yes, because it was wartime and everyone except for the Americans were a bit scruffy, and they, of course, were always immaculate, followed by small children wanting chewing gum, which always rather upset me. And I suppose the war had been getting on and we were all a bit depressed, especially ones who had fiancés as I had fighting, and, you know, the blackout and things. But even so, I managed to enjoy myself going out on bike rides and meeting up with friends in various places and going to Cambridge and Oxford. And all the people were here sort of pulled together and were very friendly and helpful.
You mentioned that there were children with chewing gum.
Oh, well, no, that was only outside the gates. The local outside children, no, they weren't allowed in. It was very carefully monitored. We had to show our pass every time we came in. Because I was in the hostel, and even to get a meal, we had to just show our pass to soldiers at the gate. I mean, quite informal, but, you know, you wouldn't get in without one. And then all the transports rolled up with people from various places, because some were as far away as Bedford. But I was lucky because I was, you know, so near.
Where, in fact, was the hostel?
Well, that's just it. I was looking for it, but it's been pulled down. As you come up Wilton Avenue, it was on the right, a road down, and there were six units. Quite pleasant, you know, we had a little room to ourselves, very small, of course, and adequate washing facilities, and a sort of common room. You know, as we all worked shifts, we were all there at different times, and you had to be quiet and near the bedrooms.
Right.
I failed the medical for the Wrens because I have terrible circulation, and they thought that was a bad thing. So therefore, I went for an interview in London, and I was learning typing, where I happened to meet a girl who had known a cousin of mine, which might have helped, I don't know. And I was told that the work was sort of strenuous and hard and boring, but I'd be with a lot of nice people, which was all totally true, and would I consider it? So I did. And I was a bit upset, really, because I was living on the south coast, sort of in the middle of the war, with, you know, a lot of excitement going on, and Bletchley seemed a bit sort of out of it, as it were. We didn't really realise how important the sort of tiny bit of work we did, you know, but we did have interesting lectures by various high-up members of the staff, you know, after things had happened, how work that we had done had helped the soldiers at the front and the airmen and the Navy. Well, of course, they were quite a long time after the event and we weren't allowed to talk about them.
You know, we've sort of swept it from our minds because we weren't allowed to talk about it for all these years. And when we had our first reunion, we had a reunion of the MR and the Watch in 1981, and that was the first connection we'd had. That was in London, just a, more or less a private one. And you did start thinking, but it was like raking it out of the past, you know, quite right. Difficult to remember.
Is this the reunion that was held in somebody's flat?
That's right.
Yes.
It's actually very difficult to be able to talk about something which you've locked away for so long.
Yes, yes.
I still don't really remember it.
Mm-hmm.
It's completely gone.
I've been asking people how they first heard that they can now talk about it in, I think, 76, and nobody's...
Well, there's a lot of...
Well, it's quite, yes.
Yeah, nobody seems to have been informed, it's just they've just...
No, that's right. Yes, yes.
In fact, it was on the radio when I was driving in the car in the 70s. I remember driving home on 5 o'clock programme on Radio 4. Mm-hmm. It came across... And I nearly swerved off the road, actually.
Today focused my mind on it because there were references to the Official Secrets Act. I had assumed that when it got this publicity in 74, right. You could talk about it all.
Yeah, right.
And today they implied that there's still things you mustn't talk about.
Yeah,
well, how do you know which?
Well, I have no idea.
Except for common sense.
I don't think that's right.
No, I don't think it can be.
I think the 30-year rule is a clear rule. And why everybody knew about it was... It was such a momentous date. A lot of people were then writing books and everything just because the data became available.
Yes.
I should have thought they were so outdated now. Things have changed to such an extent. I shouldn't have thought they were relevant to anything that happens
now. I think that's
now.
Probably true, and I think it's a very good thing that these books were published because... Yes. If everybody had gone to their graves without saying anything, a lot of things which actually affected the war very fundamentally wouldn't have become apparent.
That would have been a pity.
And I can't see that this sort of thing is doing anybody any harm at this stage.
I should think.
I think it was there, the
summer. Yeah, maybe. Or just the corner of the tennis courts, I should think.
This didn't cling at all, it wasn't right. Wasn't right at all. Did I come and go into the house or what sort of
Yes, it's open.
It's open. Mm. What are you going to do now, Douglas? You're going home, aren't you?
No, it's I'm going to get in my motor car and drive north to continue the other part of my life. I am teaching in Manchester tonight.
What are you teaching? Singing. Some sort, yeah. Douglas, has been nice to see you.
Nice to see you too.
Lovely.
And we'll, Douglas, be in touch again.
I bet you don't, but I hope you do.
Next month, we'll bring you more from the party that saved Bletchley Park. We'll share some of the insights into what life was like, apart from the all-important work these people were doing, looking both inside and out the gates of Bletchley Park. Thanks to the paid and volunteer staff, visitors and veterans who took part in this podcast. To find out more, go to bletchleypark.org.uk. You can follow Bletchley Park on Twitter, Facebook and Instagram. This podcast is produced for the Bletchley Park Trust by MC Fontaine and Catherine White and supported by Audioboom. If you like this podcast, don't be shy, write us a ripping review on iTunes. Thanks for listening, and we'll have more decrypts from the home of the Codebreakers next month.